Tell me this. Tell me if this is not the formula for a biopic.
Okay.
We meet the character in their youth, or maybe it starts out showing them at their peak, and then it flashbacks to their youth, and we start going into it. Okay. And I haven't seen any of these recent rash of biopics, but I'm just telling you.
Okay.
So then there's like all these little things where it's like, this person has something. They have a gift. They have a little thing, but nobody really understands them. Mm-hmm. And so they do some sort of thing to like break out of that. It's their big,
thing.
It's like their big, break. Right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then one thing leads to another and they start rising this wave of like success. Mm-hmm. And at some point there's a scene where they, you know, someone hands them like, hey, you got to try out the cocaine. And, no, man, it'll give you the energy to do this show today. Okay, fine. Then they start doing this downward spiral where they get deep into some sort of substance abuse. They start pushing away everybody who's been good to them in their lives and they have the fall. And then they sort of have this come to Jesus moment where they're like, I gotta clean my life up. And they sort of do this this repentance thing where they're like, you know, forgive me, I was wrong. And they do like their final like return show and everybody loves them. The end.
I will say that everyone is a variation on that theme. It's it's totally true. Did you see A Star Is Born with Lady Gaga?
Hold on, I lost my sound all of a sudden. Just a second.
You didn't see
what
that
happened there.
You did see that, Will?
I did.
Yeah, so it follows that theme.
It was hard to watch, but it was also really good.
Yeah, it was unexpected end for me. I didn't know that happened.
But did I get it right? Did I get it right? Like, that's
no.
Pretty much it.
Well, up to a certain point in A Star Is Born, it goes, are you going to watch it? Because I don't want to give it away.
I don't need to watch it. I lived it.
Oh, wow. Daniel, cut that in.
Make that sure that's
okay.
In.
Tell me what happened. So let me ask you guys this. Where are you in your biopic movie? Like if there's a biopic of your life, where are you in that?
I'm in the bottle right now.
Will's in the process of pickleball. Pushing away everyone.
I guess I'm also in the downward spiral. Because I just fired my agent.
Yeah.
I don't understand. I need you guys.
No, actually what's happening to us though is we've become investors and business people. So so there are a lot of Hollywood actors that have gone into directing, gone into producing movies, investing in movies, and it's a natural cycle.
Yeah.
It's very rare for people to create for 50 years, 60 years.
You know, we were just watching,
at least I tell myself that.
We were watching A Wind Rises this weekend. I don't know if you've seen that, but it was Miyazaki's last film. Miyazaki's the Studio Ghibli guy who did Spirited Away and My Neighbor Totoro. Have you guys seen any of those?
Didn't he?
No, man. What are you talking about? Never heard of those.
Didn't he do the Flintstones?
No.
He didn't do the Flintstones? Okay.
I love you guys. You guys are totally.
I hope you aren't serious with that last statement. You guys heard of that? I don't know.
I was serious, and here's why.
Wow.
I said Miyazaki, and you didn't nod. You kind of looked at me vacantly. Should I know this guy?
I love you explaining Miyazaki.
I know. We know Totoro. So,
Japanese Walt Disney.
I did some Totoro fan art. You have to include that. That is just so, I have too. Matter of fact, I got a cease and desist because I included Totoro in it.
Yeah.
And I got a cease and desist. We had a whole conversation about it.
Jake, that's the fact that you assumed we didn't know that made us.
Yeah, it says a lot.
Jake's talking to us like we're
his grandparents.
Yeah.
I forget. You guys are getting so old. I feel like I'm at the old folks home every time. Like I'm doing a service here. Like Oh, these guys need some socialization.
Yeah,
better go talk to them. So anyways, we were watching Spirit Away, and that movie is all about the creator. No, it was wasn't Spirit Away. We were watching Wings of Flight. What was it called? When the Wind. I said it earlier. Now I forgot the name. I'm the old the old folk. The Wind Rises. That's what it's called, and it's about the guy, the engineer who designed the Japanese Zero, the plane that. Do you guys know what the Zero is?
Yes,
the
Japanese Zero.
So there's this war, World War II.
That was the first flight, right? That was the Wright brothers that did that.
Where's my Jello?
The Wright brothers' first plane was named Zero.
No. Oh, I'm the worst. Anyways,
this story is
the point I'm trying
really
to make here.
It's good stuff.
Wow.
The point I'm trying to make here, it's the whole movie is like an allegory for the creative life, right? Like, I feel like he's writing, it's a movie about the guy who made the Japanese Zero, but
right.
it could be about Miyazaki himself. And because he has these dreams as a child that he wants to he wants to fly airplanes, but he can't. So he needs to make airplanes, right? And then he goes through this career where he keeps having these dreams about airplanes and ideas coming to him in these dreams. And then he goes and executes them in real life. And it's very artistic. It's very beautiful. But one of the things, as he's in one of these dreams, he's meeting with this Italian, aeronautics engineer, his sort of idol. And the guy says to him, an artist is only creative for 10 years. And he says, it's the same for engineers. So, so it essentially it was like a caution, like you have 10 years to come up with some cool ideas and then a lifetime to execute them. And Miyazaki has said that too. And if you look at his work, every one of his films he's created goes back to some sort of idea or sketches or something that he developed like in his 30s, and it wasn't until his 40s when he started making animated films, and he's been making them into his 70s now or 80s, and they're all like these reflections of ideas that he had early on. So that had something to do with what you guys were talking about before. Anyways, let's start the podcast.
No, wait, let's touch on that for a second, though. But do you believe that?
I think it holds some truth. Like, well, here's what I think. I think the stuff you create in your 20s has like an unhinged energy that you, it's very rare to tap into in your 40s and 50s, right?
We get more predictable. We get more safe. We get more methodical, and we stop seeing, we stop having epiphanies really.
So do you think the exception to those rules are what makes the lifelong genius? Like, I'm thinking just off the top of my head, like Leonardo da Vinci and Michelangelo and then Picasso, those kind of people who really do, not only do they create their whole lives, but they change.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think a contemporary person would be like Mike Mignola, comic artist.
Yeah.
He created a thing called Hellboy.
All right.
But if you look at him, his style now is, if you held it up next to the stuff he was creating in his 20s, completely different. It still has like his deep dark blacks into it, but it's so polished and stylized compared to what he was doing before. Before it looked like he was drawing comic pages, and now it looks like he's like sculpting and sculpting with ink essentially. And so I don't think he could come up with Hellboy today, he had to come up with in his 30s.
Oh, there's a good quote that reminds me of with this, and that is, if you're doing the same thing at 60 that you were at 20, then you wasted 40 years. Which is interesting. I think it's true.
Yeah, I got to think about that. Dang, because 60 is coming up for me in 16 years. even less for Will.
That's like tomorrow for Will.
I know. All right.
That's some good banter. We should include all that stuff. That's an interesting, it's an interesting topic for the developmental changes and interests over a lifetime. I mean, we've talked about it in terms of a success arc, but we haven't talked about it in terms of the work you like making and where the work comes from.
Right. Interesting. Yeah. And I should say too, like, it's okay to change your mind too. What gives you energy and excites you as a 33-year-old isn't the same thing maybe that was like getting you going as a 23-year-old. And it might not be the thing that gets you excited as a 53-year-old, you know? Like, there's it's okay to evolve.
There's a theme that runs through it. Like, one of my projects I did at Art Center, which I really enjoyed, was I illustrated, you know, I had this printmaking class and I had to come up with just a self-driven, every project at Art Center is self-driven. But it had to be, it's printmaking. So each image takes a long time to make. So I had to come up with a series of images that isn't too many images. I couldn't make a children's book or something like that.
Right.
So I had to come up with something and I ended up illustrating the Seven Deadly Sins. Which feels exactly like doing this tarot deck. It was the exact same problem with the Seven Deadly Sins, sloth and jealousy and all that kind of stuff. So themes.
Did you know the SpongeBob characters are all based on the Seven Deadly Sins?
No, really?
Yeah.
Really?
No.
Look
which
it
one
up.
Which one is SpongeBob?
SpongeBob's lust.
What about Squidward?
Squidward is...
you are lying.
I'm not. Squidward is vanity.
Oh.
Mr. Krabs is greed. Sandy's pride. She's from Texas.
I'm seeing this. There's actually a graphic.
Yeah.
With them. Oh, my God. See, now that's the kind of investigative kind of illustration / concept that I'm talking about. Of doing the hard work, not drawing what's expected, like Jake Parker likes to do.
it's cool though, because and then you got funny. What Patrick is sloth and
Gluttony is that snail.
Yeah, Gary the snail. So
very interesting,
and I think that's why
the best episode of SpongeBob since we're here. Is Pinky's in the Air and the I don't need it, the water.
Oh.
You know, where he goes to Sandy's house, SpongeBob goes to Sandy's and Patrick's on the outside of her little dome thing.
The water one. Yep.
Yeah.
I like the swearing one. I
definitely
one.
Don't need it. The swearing one's good. Yeah.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to 3-Point Perspective, the podcast about illustration, how to do it, how to make a living at it, how to make an impact in the world with your art. I'm Jake Parker.
I'm Lee White.
And I'm Will Terry. And all three of us are professional illustrators. We've all illustrated for just about all the major publishers in the business. We've illustrated somewhere around 70 books between us, and we've all taught illustration at universities.
Yep. Each week we take questions from you guys, our trusty listeners, and we try to answer them as best we can. Sometimes we agree. A lot of times we're going to argue, but each time you're going to learn something brand spanking new.
You know what we should do on the last part? You should go, sometimes we agree, and I go, sometimes we disagree, and then Jake should go, but each time.
Yeah, that's
good. Maybe that's what we do next time.
Let's practice it one time right now.
Why don't we all in sync do... the last line.
That's what I'm saying.
Oh, okay.
Go ahead.
Okay, here we go.
So, go for it, Lee.
You started.
What am I we take questions from you guys, our trusty listeners. Each week we take questions from you guys, our trusty listeners. Sometimes we agree.
Sometimes we disagree.
But every time you learn something new.
Let's not do this, okay?
I thought we were going to do it in unison. But each time you're going to learn something.
Learn something new.
Oh.
Brand spanking new.
I missed the memo on that part.
Okay, so question number one.
All right, let's go.
This comes from Corey, titled Picture Book Pitch. Should I just
wait a second? I got to cut this podcast off. What? And let our listeners know that the SpongeBob SquarePants characters are based on the seven deadly sins. We were talking about where concepts come from. It's just so mind blowing. And it's such an interesting little kind of tidbit in my day that we have to, and that's not general knowledge. We're talking about where do concepts come from and how do you get past a top card concept, a cliche concept. And so we were debating all these kind of techniques or whatever. And then Jake told us that SpongeBob is the seven deadly sins. You guys got to Google that if you haven't seen it before, because it's so interesting that like SpongeBob is based on the lust deadly sin and Patrick is sloth. And my mind is kind of blown right now. I'm looking at the graphic and I'm thinking, that is how you come up with something interesting, is you marry two unconventional things and all of a sudden you get, you go somewhere different. So that's our teaching moment of the moment.
You're really excited about this, Lee.
I am, because concepts are hard. Concepts are hard. And we get too many submissions that are cliche.
I had this cool idea too. I don't know if I'm actually going to use it, but I've been sort of sitting with this character for the last 10 years. It seems like Skull Chaser. He's like a dead spaceman. And my idea was that he went through this experience where his body was essentially like dematerialized and he came back to life as a skeleton, essentially. But my idea was, is that, usually you see this in characters. There's a set of characters where it's, a group of three, and one character symbolizes like the mind, and one character symbolizes the heart, and one character symbolizes the gut. And so the mind is like the intellectual, and they're always like, wait, is this the thing we should be doing, or should we be doing this? You know, my calculations say, you know, maybe we should follow this path. It's the most logical. And then the heart person is like, I believe in myself and I believe in us and we could do anything and let's follow our passion and go, you know, conquer this thing. And then the gut is like, does whatever serves themselves. Like, you guys go do your thing. I'm going to go over here and just like satisfy myself with, you know, this big bowl of chili or whatever. Right. And so you look at like Princess Leia, Luke Skywalker and Han Solo, and Princess Leia is like the logic where she's like, there's an empire and it needs to be brought down and I'm going to start a rebellion and we're going to figure out how to do this. She's the brains of the operation. Luke Skywalker's the heart. He's like, I just want to be a Jedi like my father before me. And, you know, he's unwieldy and he's like, you know, he's got the force and he's following like his heart, right? You know, he's following the soul of the spirit of it. And then you have Han Solo, who's just like, as long as you guys pay me at the end of this so I can get out of debt from Jabba, we're all good, you know? So I was thinking with Skull Chaser, what if he encounters three characters in his life, one representing logic, one representing heart, or following your heart, and one representing following your gut. And it turns out that they're all parts of him. You know, they're all like physical manifestations of pieces of him that he lost when he turned into Skull. And so it's like, as he helps them, he regains those pieces, you know, those pieces in him. I should say the most obvious example of this is Wizard of Oz.
That's exactly where I was getting ready to say.
But
everything gets recycled.
Yeah. You've heard of Wizard of Oz, right?
I have not heard. What is this?
Let me tell you two things that I think are true about you and Skull Chaser, Jake.
Okay. Is this going to be a roast?
Psychoanalysis.
No, this is here to help you. I'm here to help you. I'm
not okay, here. Good. I need help. I need all the help I can get.
Two things. One.
Let's hear it.
I think all of your fans know that are waiting for you to release a Kickstarter with Skull Chaser in a comic. So the truth is, it would do phenomenally well. Mm-hmm. The second thing is, the reason you haven't done it yet is because you're afraid that you only get one chance to do it. And if you screw it up, it's done.
You have nailed that so squarely on the head.
Because really I have seen like the pins. I've seen the drawings. I've seen like, how much you love it. I've seen the comments that you get. Mm-hmm. And I've seen people begging for it. And I'm like, he's not cruel. He's not keeping it from his fans because he's cruel.
Is he chasing
the reason?
Is he chasing a skull? Why is he skull chaser? But he's a skull. What's that about?
Yeah, so it's like a nickname. He just goes by Skull, but the property is Skull Chaser, and sort of that's his nickname in the underworld is because he's a bounty hunter, and so that's like slang for a bounty hunter is a chaser.
Oh, okay. That's the way. This is the way.
I just made that up. No, I never spoken that before. It was always in the back of my head. So I appreciate you asking.
Oh, interesting. Cued it up.
Now that the truth is out, you have to deal with these demons.
And I'm so afraid of making a second rate product. Like, yeah, the art's great, but the story's stupid.
Right.
And maybe I shouldn't worry about that because I love so many comics that are where the art's great and the story's stupid. I don't care, you know.
No, you want to get both of them.
I want to get both of them. But I've been so worried about that I've even thought, well, does it have to be a comic in order to exist as like a intellectual property? Like, look at those designer toys made by Ashley Wood. I forget, it was like, what was it called? Popbot or, I forget the brand name of them, but Ashley Wood was this comic artist and he came out with this line of toys back in the early 2000s. And he started building out this world through toys. So he'd come out with a set of robots and he'd come out with a set of robot fighters and then he'd come out with like a set of like, you know, sexy girl robot fighters. And then he'd come out with more robots and they all existed in this world. And he sort of had these loose, like you get a little piece of the story on the box art and maybe you get a little piece of story in like a catalog for them. And he put out a little book that has little chunks of stories in it. I'm like, he is building a world and he's not even telling a story. Like he's just sharing the stuff.
Hinting at a story. It sounds like.
And so I was thinking like, well, what if I just did that with Skull Chaser? He's on a t-shirt. He's on a pin. He's
the Jake Parker I know wouldn't be content.
Don't be a baby.
You won't be content with that.
I know. So going back to that, like that was my thoughts 5 years ago. And then there, you know, two roads that diverge in a yellow wood, right? And I was like, I have to work on some stuff that's a little more of a sure thing. So let's work on SVS. Let's make that thing happen. Let's put some time and effort into Inktober and maybe build that up a little bit more. You know, let's do some children's books. And those were all like more sure things, right? Like they were a little bit more substantial. And it was a way for me to like push off this problem of what's the story.
Mm-hmm. You got to earn.
Yeah, but this summer we were on a road trip and the family, we stopped in the city, gotten off the freeway, stopped in the city, this little town, I should say, somewhere outside of Philadelphia. And the family all went to the bathroom and I was sitting there parked.
You saw Skull Chaser graffiti?
No.
Okay.
No. What I did was I saw a comic shop and I was like, I'm going to go in that comic shop. And so I went into that comic shop and I was like, it'd been a while since I'd really been in a comic shop. And I'm looking around and I saw on the shelf there, this comic called Beta Ray Bill. And it's by Daniel Warren Johnson. And I'm a huge fan of him. I've been following his work for years, but I hadn't really sat down and read some comics lately, other than old comics that I had done before. Sorry, this podcast episode is turning into like Jake's psychoanalysis like therapy session. But
I didn't know mentioning SpongeBob was gonna dive this deep, but go ahead.
But I was like, Beta Ray Bill, that looks so cool. I love Daniel's work. I'm gonna buy whatever issues they had, the issues 2 and 3 or 2 and 4 or something like that. And I pulled them off the shelf and I cracked them open. I'm just like, this got me, it's like so exciting. It's so well done. It's so well crafted. So I went to another comic shop the next time we stopped. Like we were meeting at a restaurant, and I was like, I'm going to go park the car, guys. And so I went and parked the car and ran over to a comic shop, bought the other two issues, and then met them at the restaurant. And then on vacation, I read through these comics, and I was like, I just had this like overwhelming feeling like this is the kind of thing I want to be doing and I want to make. And I need to arrange my life in a way so that I can take the risk and set aside the time to actually sit down and make my Skull Chaser comic or any comic. And like Scotty Young, he once said, he's a friend of mine. He once said, breaking into comics isn't hard. And he compares it to breaking out of prison. You know, people could break out of prison and it happens. I don't want to say it happens all the time, but it happens. And then what happens to those people? They get put back into prison. They either get caught, they slip up, they do something, you know, stupid. The cops find them, they go back to prison. He said, the hard thing is staying out of prison. And so if you look at like this life that you're living in, which is where you feel trapped and where you feel like you're not being able to do the thing you want to do as a prison, trying to figure out a way to break out is very important and a very good use of your time. But the more important thing is figuring out how to stay out of prison. Like once you're out, like what do you do to keep from getting put back in? And so I look at that and I've put out two graphic novels. I've kickstarted a full graphic novel. I've done 5 issues for Marvel Comics of Rocket Raccoon. I've done comics. Like I've broken out of prison like 3 or 4 times now. But then I keep going back into prison where I'm like, oh, I can't do comics. And so this last one is like, well, let's come up with a plan where I can actually break out and stay out. So thanks for bringing that up, guys. Got me thinking.
I will say there's one annoying thing with Skull Chaser for me. And that is, I don't normally do fan art. And then I did a Skull Chaser fan art just for fun one day. And then that's like the most liked image I have on Instagram. So annoying.
That's hilarious.
So
that's
annoying. Funny.
That's funny. All right. Should we answer some other people's questions?
Let's dive in. Sorry to derail us like I did.
Okay. This is from Corey. He says, picture book pitch. Should I just let it go? Hi guys. Over the last year, I've pitched a picture book that I've written and illustrated to 2 different publishers. Unfortunately, I got back 2 passes. So book went out to 2 publishers, 2 no's. I'm still pretty excited about the idea and I'm leaning towards doing Kickstarter to self-publish. My question for you guys is, since publishers aren't interested, does that mean self-publishing is not a good idea? If they don't see it as sellable, should I take that as a sign and just move on to the next idea or power through and see if I can do it on my own? Thanks so much for your thoughts and advice. Corey. All right. I've got some thoughts on this, but I want to hear what you guys. I've
got some thoughts on this too.
Oh, man. I've got a lot of thoughts on this one.
That's a good question.
It is. It is. Well, let's hear what you think.
So there's multiple things that can be true with the speculation that he has. Like one, yeah, they could be looking at the story and saying, this is really bad, or this is really not polished enough, but it could be really good. And it could be the perfect thing that those two publishers that you sent it to don't publish, or they've just published something like it. Or they would have published it last year, but it's not in vogue this year for some, you know, there's, mm-hmm. there's so many reasons. I mean, so the classic case is Harry Potter being turned down like 13 times mm-hmm. before getting picked up. So sending off to 2 different publishers really is not a good, it's a lot of work to send to even one publisher. This is a tough business to break into as an author illustrator. Mm-hmm. But when you do get there, I really want to tell story from a friend. If we have time, I'll do it, about breaking in. Uh-huh. It's a really good story. But anyway,
let's hear it. Time for it?
No. Go. I want to answer. I want you guys to explore this question. And if we have time, I'll jump back in.
So, okay, go for it. What do you think, Lee?
I think that 2 is just scratching the surface. I do have the same feeling that Will does without seeing the story. It could be anything. So it'd be weird for us to say, no, you know, they don't know what they're talking about. You go, you're great. And you should self-publish it because it might actually not be any good. And mm-hmm. so, you know, there's that side of it, but mm-hmm. I definitely wouldn't use a commercial publisher as a gauge for quality necessarily. I would say by nature, publishing is a hard business anyway. I'm not talking about from our perspective. I'm talking about from the publisher's perspective. Mm-hmm. They got all these costs, you know, storing all these books, getting them all the book to the different bookstores, making a profit, paying all these people. So they sort of have to go with a known entity. It's rare that they go out on a limb. And so if the work is overly creative or doesn't really fit into like Will said, what's popular right now, it could be passed over and it could be fantastic. And it's a numbers game. I mean, like Will said about Harry Potter, I think Edgar Allan Poe and also Emily Dickinson ended up self-publishing their first. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's both of those. I know one of them, but ended up self-publishing because no one wanted the work. Yeah. And then they stood the test of time. And so I just wouldn't use a no as a gauge. I mean, if 100 publishers have turned you down.
Yeah, that's the thing you need. And even then, the work might be great, but it might not be suitable for publishing. See, publishing today, mass market or the big publishers, there's a lot of subjects that they're not interested in right now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, mm-hmm. So that could be a thing.
Yeah. Here's my thing. Picture books don't do well on Kickstarter. So
that's another, right. That's the other yeah. thing. Why not?
Let's and that. Your average Kickstarter is backed by like a 25 to 35 year old white male. I want to say it's something very niche like that. And so what does well in there? Tech stuff, you know, and I should say like single dudes, right? So tech stuff, board games,
comics.
Tarot decks. Comics do pretty well on there. And then I want to say like that's like the and this is me just shooting from the hip here. I don't have data in front of me, but I've read some things and looked at some things. And then it sort of branches out from there. But you look at children's book Kickstarters and the audience that would buy those just isn't buying stuff on Kickstarter. So if you're going to self-publish, you might want to go to Amazon and do it that way. You know, do maybe a print on demand thing. If you do Kickstarter, the one catch, the one thing, the outliers, I guess, that are successful are those who have a built-in audience who already loves that person's yeah. work. So yeah. like, I want to say like if the Oatmeal who did Exploding Kittens came out with a children's book, it would do phenomenally well, you know?
Right.
See, I think the way to do well with a children's book on Kickstarter is to develop an audience by giving away free short stories or writing some stories, illustrating them for children. Putting them online for free, mm-hmm. page at a time or something on your Instagram, getting a following of basically people that buy books for kids, mothers. You yeah. have to somehow get that following to then take to Kickstarter.
And then, I mean, essentially use Kickstarter for what that name actually is, to kick start something, not to kick finish something. Yeah. And so then you have a pile of, you know, 2,000 books in your garage and figuring out a way to go sell those. So I keep, you know, I brought up in, I forget which episode, it was Tim Boyle who did Great White Zeke, which is a story about, it's kind of like Tarzan, but with sharks. So this baby's raised by yeah. great white sharks. And so that right there is like really easy to pitch. You know, if you like sharks, and everybody loves sharks on some level. There's enough love for sharks to have Shark Week and enough love for sharks to have National Geographic do their version of Shark Week. They can't call it Shark Week, so they call it Sharks Week or something like that. I don't know.
Clever.
But you, he sort of has this built-in, like, people love sharks. And the way Tim marketed that was he joined – Facebook groups for sharks. And he started like posting his artwork on there, his shark artwork. And it always got a bunch of likes because, you know, posting artwork on a Facebook group, which doesn't get a lot of artwork is, you know, going to grab some attention. And then he launched a Kickstarter and he got 200 plus people to back it. And it was enough money to get, you know, a bunch of books printed. And, you know, and then he has these books that he can go sell at mom and pop bookstores or like aquarium bookstores or museum bookstores or things like that. So that's one way to do it. If your children's book is like, or your picture book is like, you know, something very general, like, you know, I want to say, you know, puppy's bad day or something like that, you know, or Timmy's bike got a flat and, you know, just something that you would kind of expect in a children's book. I don't think it'll do well on Kickstarter, but if it has a very unique sort of,
edgy angle if it was, to it, if it was a go the F to sleep book or something like
that. Yeah. Or all my friends are dead about dinosaurs or, you know, a baby raised by sharks, you know, like then I think Kickstarter could be the thing. And we've talked about this before too. If like, if you are serving a community that isn't getting served by the major publishers, you could have a chance to be successful.
The nightmare book.
Yeah.
The before bedtime nightmare book.
Yeah. No. There's no wake up books. Maybe, you know, there's bedtime books, but there's no like wake up books.
Right. So there's that, yeah.
All right. Next question. Master
Do you want? Do we have time for me to rip that story out, or should
how,
I just?
What are you? What are you thinking? A five minute story? How you? It, you're it's prepping us for it being big. Okay.
No. I'll shorten it.
Okay.
But it pertains.
I'm gonna go to the bathroom. Tell me when he's
done. All right. Let's hear.
All right, so this is a friend of mine. She told me this story. I'm not going to use her name, but she's been a writer for decades. She's very well established. She talks a lot at SCBWI events, and she when one of her first jobs was she got a job as a secretary at a publishing house, and she was not wanting to be a writer or anything, but one of her jobs was to read the manuscripts that were coming in the slush pile. She started reading stuff and seeing, like, learning about the business from the secretary standpoint of, like, this book is good, this book is not good. Listening in on the other editors talking about books, hating on books, loving on books. And every year, year after year, she's hearing this chatter in the from the editors on these manuscripts that are coming in. So she starts thinking, you know, I might be able to just write on the side as I have my job here. I can write at home and I can actually submit under a pseudonym to myself because she was the one that read the manuscripts and kicked them on. Right. So have I told you guys this story before?
No.
Okay. So
believe I haven't heard this.
Yeah. So, good one.
she brings her manuscript in and puts it in with the pile of ones that she was supposed to sift through and weed out the bad ones. And she puts hers in with the good and sends it into the meeting. And the editors are in there and they were laughing at her manuscript. Mm. And she was trying to fight back tears, you know, because it was harsh what she was hearing. And she thought it was going to be easy to write and it wasn't, but she would get notes back and then she had to mail these manuscripts back to the authors who sent them in. So she got her manuscript with notes and she had to type up her own rejection letters. And she learned what she was doing wrong, resubmitted. Anyway, over time and multiple stories. And I mean, to hear her tell it is like you're on the edge of your seat.
Yeah.
And when she got the final one accepted, she breaks down crying in the office. And her editor doesn't understand because she's using a pseudonym, right?
Yeah.
And she's like, what is going on? What is wrong? And she's like, that's my story, you know, that you just accepted. And they both cried together. And it was just a really cool thing. But the reason that I tell that story is because she went through so so much writing and rewriting and revisions and rejection and rejection. I mean, typing up rejection letters, multiple rejection letters for herself, that, I mean, it's just it's a long process, but mm-hmm. when you get there and you get something that's sellable, the cream rises to the top eventually, but you have to be writing a lot.
Yeah.
And submitting a lot.
Yeah. Good story, Will. Good story. Okay. Next question. Master copies from Mark. First and foremost, I enjoy your podcast and I love to listen to you guys discuss art and illustration. Thank you. In one or more of the podcasts, Lee mentioned that when he makes a master copy, he uses a guideline to analyze his work and the work that he's copying. Can you tell me what that is? I'm interested to know because I enjoy doing master copies and learning from them. So, Lee, what's your little trick there for master copies?
I don't have the sheet in front of me that I made, but I just kind of list out what the concept is and see if it's some kind of theme that I can learn from. And so each time I do a master copy, it's not just doing the master copy. It's more like a hypothesis, I guess, that I start to form by looking at somebody's work. So first off, I think about what the concept is, what the theme is, but then I go through all the art elements. How are they using composition? And then how does that enhance the theme? And I'll answer that question. I mean, really specific questions though. How are they using value? How are they controlling edges, and where are those edges? Are they soft edges? Are they hard edges? How are they bringing, Will Terry's been talking a lot about how to drive attention to a focal point. How are these artists achieving a focal point, and what devices are they using for that? And so I make this, like, you know, I'll have the image on the center of a piece of paper. Typically I'll scan it into InDesign. And then I have all these things like value, and then I'll have arrows going everywhere. Maybe I'll provide one. If you go to our show notes, I can show you what one of these looks like. I did one for Bart Forbes. I think it's pretty elaborate. He's a great illustrator and I'm really trying to learn from it. So I'll make this document, and this document isn't really that important as it, the next document that I look at from his or from that artist. I typically look at two or three different pieces of work. And then I test that first one against the second one. Okay. Is the theme consistent? Is the way they're using edges consistent? Is the, how they're driving the focal point consistent? Many times it is, sometimes it's not though. And then you have to reform your hypothesis. And then when I'm all done with that, I do, a master copy, a new work in their style. And I see what part of their style I want to incorporate into what I'm doing. And many times it's just one little thing, like, you know, out of this whole person's work, I was really just attracted to the line quality. Mm. And that's it. Or how they're using value, or, you know, some thematic thing, or, you know, whatever. And so, so it's really specific. It's not just like, oh, my picture looks like that one.
Interesting. Yeah. That's cool. I, the past, I want to say 15 years, I've been doing, if I do a master study, it's more it's more like, how do I do something in that person's style, my own creation in that style, right? So it's less trying to make an exact copy of that, and more like, maybe even like combining two people into one. So yeah. It's like, how would Mobius and Dr. Seuss work together to make something, you know? The weird shape language of Dr. Seuss with the line style of Mobius.
Mm-hmm. So that's a great way to do it. Yeah. I should add that, I mean, it's a great little disclaimer you're adding right there, is that you don't want to do master copies and just stick with one person. My little analogy I tell my students is, you know, think of your style evolving as you walking through a forest where there's all kinds of different flowers, and you're picking the flowers that you're attracted to. And at the end of this journey, my bouquet of flowers is going to be different than your bouquet of flowers. And so that's sort of how I view master copies. Like, you're picking this and that and this and that. And if you just have one thing of flowers, you're just too much of that. You're just going to be an imitation of that. But as you get these little things, oh, I like the line quality here. I love the contrast here. I love the themes over here and the costume design over here. And all of a sudden you end up with this really beautiful and very, very specific and individual style.
That's cool. All right. Next question. How to sell your art without social media? This person didn't want us to use their name. So, hey guys, I don't know. if I don't want to go the Instagram Twitter route and also don't want to get a job in the industry, my country doesn't have many good options, but I want to start my own business of selling art someday, is there any way to do it without banking on posting your art online on social media? I feel like these platforms are filled with thousands of artists, and ultimately it comes down to how much you interact with your followers and how you engage with them. In case somebody is an introvert and isn't too comfortable interacting with followers without passing off as rude, is there any way to still achieve traction? Also, I just want to say that your podcast is amazing and you guys are hilarious and so, so insightful. Thank you for all that you do. So yeah, what do you think? Lee, you don't have much of a social media following.
I sort of had a follow-up question to his question. I can't answer because I'm terrible at social media. My follow-up question is, what happens to a lot of our audience is children's book specific and graphic novels. And these are big projects. For me right now, I'm doing a big project. It's going to take the next couple of months. I don't have daily or sometimes even weekly stuff to share because it's all such in the thumbnails and loose sketch stage. And I just don't have anything to post. And so I feel the urge to like, I should be posting something, but I'm working my way through all these sketches. So my social media is like
lagging. Sketches. Why can't you post sketches?
Dude, they're so rough at this. I mean, they're not even the rough sketch. They're really just thumbnails and notes and like, they don't even, it's gibberish at this point, but I understand it's almost a shorthand for what I'm going to be doing.
I feel your pain, Lee.
It's not at that cool stage. It's not Jake at the cool
draws,
stage.
Everything Jake draws is like beautiful line quality.
How do you That's do bad drawings, Lee?
I don't call them drawings even yet. I call them thinkings because they really are. Thinkings. There's like an arrow saying, oh, there's a group of people back here. Or, you know, like a circle saying, oh, that's a car. You know, it's not even a thing yet.
Yeah.
The next stage will be the cool stage where I'm actually drawing. And then I could share that, but I don't know, man. I got this long phase, probably another 3 weeks in this phase of no posting, and it's taken all my time. I can't say, well, I'm just not going to do this project so I can make something for social media.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, so go ahead, Lee. I mean, Will, whoever you are.
I think there's a direct correlation to the quality of your art and the need for social media. If you're putting out art at the quality of James Jean, you can afford to say to not list an email or any way to contact him on your website. Mm-hmm. You know, like everything goes through the rep, through the agent. Yeah. And so maybe the way to do it, if you're an introvert, you don't want to engage with anyone, you don't want to participate in any of that. And there's nothing wrong with the desire of not wanting to engage in social media, I don't think. But if you want that, you're going to need someone to sell your work for you. Mm-hmm. You're going to need a gallery or some way of getting your work out into the public where they can see it and start following it and start following you. I just think there's a direct correlation to the quality of the art that you have to make. It has to be that much better because you're cutting off a huge opportunity by not using social media. Anyway,
they bring up a good point, and that is there's so many artists on Instagram and Twitter and all these platforms. How do you even, you know, how do you even make a splash or even make a ripple among this? And that's a real problem. But Will's got a good point. If your artwork is so stinking good, it can sort of speak for itself or other people can speak for it and share it around. I should say though, that like it doesn't hurt to, you can just post, have an Instagram account and just post stuff because you want to have somebody be able to share your artwork or post it on Twitter. You don't have to engage with people. You can just post and leave it there. Because if you're just posting on a website or something not on social media, it's hard for people to pull those images and bring them in to where they need to be, to be shared. So I would say like either you get in good with a gallery or a publisher or something like that who does have the bandwidth and the leverage to like share your stuff, or you have to put your artwork up somewhere, you know? The other thing is you could just have an offline business, and maybe you sell your artwork, you know, you find a bookstore or a coffee shop or something like that, someplace where people are going to be, and you sell your work there and kind of grow it organically out of that. And maybe do shows, you know, art fairs and conventions and things like that. Because you're going to have eyeballs walking past your work in a very specific way. And should you do that, regardless of any of these things, you need to grow your email list, because mm-hmm. when you do set up an online shop or you do have a gallery showing or anything, you're going to want to be able to contact people and just tell them, here's where my artwork's at. Here's how it's available. And I could say you will do, you'll do 10 times better with 1,000 emails than you will with 1,000 followers on Instagram easily, you know? Mm-hmm.
I want to add a point here on this one. I'm going to call him out. Since he didn't leave a name, I can call him out. There's an irony here in this email.
The dad talk.
This is the dad talk. There's an irony here that I don't think that they see, and that they say, I don't want to be on social media. It's filled with too many artists and there's so much, how do you make a difference? Well, guess what? But then in the next sentence, he says, I want to start my own business. Well, being a business as an artist is the exact same thing. There's so many artists in business. How could you possibly make a splash if you start an art business? Mm. It's the exact same argument. He's saying one of them's okay, and the other one, he doesn't want to go up against that much competition, but he's already against that much competition when you just say, I'm an artist and I'm in business.
I think what they're really saying more than anything else is they don't want to.
They don't want to interact. Engage. I understand that, but it's
they don't want that job,
right? But I think Will's point, I think Will said it, is correct, in that it has to be a part of your planning, and how much you want to interact with it is totally up to you. But to say I don't want to use it because I don't like social media is cutting off the biggest access point that people have to your business. If you say you're going to be in business, that's part of it in this world that we live in. I mean, in addition to collecting emails and doing all the stuff that Jake just said to you.
Here's a question. Like, what if I could turn on your social media account, your Instagram account, and immediately give you 50,000 followers, like right away, just out of the gate? These are all people handpicked to like mm-hmm. your stuff. You know, the algorithm just sets you up so that you click on your social media, turn it on, you set up the account, and boom, 50,000. Would you want to do social media then? Or right. still does that like, no, I don't want to have to interact with all those people or post my artwork for all those people, you know? And if I could guarantee that your artwork could be seen by, you know, every day, 10,000 people, would you want that or say no to that? And so it sounds like, I don't know any artist who would say no to that, but that kind of stuff comes with a lot of work. And unfortunately, in this day and age, I think an aspect of your job as a creator is to be like a little bit, maybe this isn't any different. You have to hustle a little bit. You gotta like, you know, share your stuff and show it around and network. It could be, I mean, there's more than one way to do it. Like, mm-hmm. like it could be that, that you make some quality stuff and you just submit it to a publisher and you start getting like book cover deals. Right. And so your work is consistently being shown on book covers, you know, every month. For different books. Well, now you're getting the same benefits of social media, except it's through the publisher, right? But mm-hmm. in order to get there, you're looking at like a 5-year ramp up, I think, in order to get that kind of solid, solid work.
Brett Hellquist kind of had that career. Mm-hmm. He doesn't ever done social media.
Yeah.
You know, he's the guy that illustrated the covers and the interior art for a series of unfortunate events.
But is he still working?
Yeah, he does children's books. that what happened is that that series was so big and so popular, and he knocked it out of the park on that.
Yeah, he nailed it.
That he became highly sought after by publishers after that, and had a great, still has a great career. Yeah. So now, could he have amplified that, his career on social media? Yeah, but there was, I know there was a time where he was literally 3 years booked with with assignments. And at that, when you're looking at 3 years of work, you know, you can't really come up for air for 3 years. You're not really concerned about finding more work.
Right.
And you're not really going to be concerned about using social media to find more work that you can't possibly do right now. Right.
Yeah. I really think early on, your focus as a creator, you know, in your 20s, shouldn't be, how do I build a social media following? It should be, how do I become the best in the world at this thing I want to do? And like that should consume you. Mm-hmm. And it might mean that you work at Home Depot nights, you know, or you're a janitor at nights, so that your creative hours in the day are devoted to your craft. Mm-hmm. And so you don't have to worry about making money to do your craft. Like you've got your job, or your spouse has a job, or, you know, if you're super lucky, you've got a trust fund or something like that. So you could focus on your craft, because I think there's a book called So Good They Can't Ignore You. And it's by Cal Newport. And the whole gist of that is, focusing on certain skills that set you apart from every, you know, very high quality skills that make you desirable by someone, you know, either a fan base who wants to hire you or who wants to buy your work, or someone in a position to hire you. And so like, if you're super good at drawing the figure and you're very good at storytelling and you've got a very unique style, Marvel's going to be knocking at your door once they see your portfolio. You know, they're going to want you to draw comics. You know, if you're really good at rendering and you could do light and shadow and you've got like a cinematographer's eye, you know, to essentially something that could be filmed, but you're able to create it with your art, Disney's going to be knocking at your door as soon as they see your portfolio. So all that focus and you just have to show it to one or two of the right people. If that's the route you want to go. Now, if you want to build a fan base, then there's going to, you know, and have this like self, employed sort of aspect to it where you're just working, you know, selling stuff to fans, then you're going to have to put in some of that hard work of building a fan base online. You know, building that email list, building those followerships. But still you can't neglect mastering your craft. Like you have to be really good at it. And I have to say, like, if your art isn't 100% good, then your voice, your storytelling, your humor has to be 100%, you know, it has to be that good. Because we see that time and time again where there's artists that are like average, you know, your Scott Adams, you know, Dilbert guys, Dilbert. Your Gary Larson's, your Matt Inman oatmeals, where the art, you know, is funny to look at, but it's not like masterful.
It carries the idea.
It just carries the idea, but where they are masterful is unique perspective, you know, humorous perspective. So you have to be top of your game at in some aspect there, and that's what should be the focus.
They say that in Deep Work too, that same book. Yeah. That's the same idea. So that's kind of, I've seen that kind of floating around a lot of places. So there must be definitely something to it. Mm-hmm. You guys never answered what I should do about my individual problem, where you have a long-term project, you don't have stuff to post yet, but and the hours are just ticking by. Do you just post old stuff?
Oh, I got a thing for you. So I started following this YouTube channel by these two comic artists, and I love it. Absolutely love it. And these guys are posting a video every single day. Okay. These two comic artists.
Okay.
And they're also cranking out don't know, 8 or 9, is essentially an issue, comic book issue every month, right? They're working, they're full-time working. So how are they doing this? What are they doing? Do you know what the channel is? It's them going into their long boxes on the shelf full of comics, pulling out old issues and analyzing them, just talking about them. So they just meet up one day of the week. They kind of do what we're doing one day out of the week. And they're like, you know, let's read X-Men number 287, first, you know, the first time Jim Lee drew X-Men. And they're just talking about it. And they're like, look at this beautiful panel here. Look at how bad this storytelling is, you know, or look how good this thing is. And or they're reading old Wizard comics and just talking about it. And that doesn't, they don't ever show what they're working on. They just show what they finished. And at the beginning of every episode, it's, here's this book I finished last year, but here's why you should pick it up right now. And and every single day, you know, 7,000 views per day or whatever, people are seeing that book and eventually someone's going to buy it, right? So it doesn't have, you don't have to always be sharing your stuff.
Right.
You can be. I love that.
There's a channel I follow called Mr. Ballin, and he tells macabre stories that are true stories. Just stuff in the news. He just learns the story really well and just tells it. Cause as you're working, you want to listen to a weird story. 4 million subscribers. Each video is like 2 million views. Do you know how much money that is? And he does three or four stories a week.
See, but
he's making tens of thousands of dollars a month. Yeah.
I'm sure that's a full-time job for him now, right?
Yeah, like, probably. Maybe. I mean, yeah, but, sure.
But your point is, though, like, he is, his whole thing is, here's my filter on,
yeah,
on what I'm, what, yeah, I'm, you know,
I'm packaging it in a way that no one else is, and it's right, and it's not even his content. Wow.
But like, that's what I started doing to my YouTube channel. I've done like 6 or 7 YouTube videos since July. Kind of took a break this last month because I had a freelance project to work on, but I was like, I'm not going to draw something every time for my YouTube channel. That's exhausting. And why, you know, and it's sort of, it doesn't advance the things I want to create. It just advances the YouTube channel. Like, so what I started doing was, this is before I even saw this other YouTube channel in comics. I should mention the name of that channel. It's called Cartoonist Kayfabe. So go check that out if you're into 90s comic. They mostly review like 90s comics. It's nostalgic. So they're tapping into like the 40-somethings who collected comics when they were teenagers. But these last few videos were like, here's my Calvin and Hobbes comic collection. Let's flip through it. Here's why I like Calvin and Hobbes. And here's like, here's this, I forget what, you know, it's just stuff like me sharing stuff that I'm into. And, you know, these videos don't take a whole lot to do. And it still is, it keeps people in their mind that I exist, right? So, and then the other thing is the email list. Man, put out a weekly email that just is like, my weekly email is, my newsletter is, here's 5 things that I thought that I saw this week that were cool that I thought I'd share. And so it's like, here's a cool building on an architectural webpage I found. I really like the design of this building. Here's an amazing concept car from the 1960s. You know, here's this cool comic artist I found on Twitter and, you know, check out their art. Oh, and here's this thing I drew this week, you know. And that's all it is. And usually the 5th thing is an inspirational message. So it's a quote. It's, you know, this next week, I'll probably share that quote of the one I was talking about, holding on to something so tight that you can't give or receive that thing that I referred to earlier. So it doesn't have to be you sharing your stuff all the time. It just is you curating everything that you're experiencing. So.
Love that. I think a lot of people are going to get a lot out of that because it kind of goes back to that same question he just asked. There's a pressure to keep feeding the beast, you know, keep posting all these images. Pretty soon you got to make work. Mm-hmm. So it's a catch 22, especially when you're doing a long project. So I love that answer. I'm actually going to start doing that today. I think that's really good.
Yeah. Like if you're, I mean, look at William Joyce too. Look at his Instagram account. He does this all the time where he's like, here's 10 images of like 1930s dudes in tuxedos. And he's like, I was just doing reference search today. Here's why I love dudes in tuxedos, you know? and then he'll have like an old sketch that he did of a dude in a tuxedo that he drew a month ago or whatever. So do
that. That's really good.
All right. Should take us out.
No, I have one more issue. Okay. One more issue I want to run by you guys. You know, we talk about that. Even before we were actually podcasting today, we're talking about different stages of our careers and things we would do when we're starting out, things we do now. And I have a new thing happening right now that I haven't had in my career. I just wanted to bring it up to you guys, see if you've had it happen yet. I turned down a project that now obviously the publishers and clients give the project to somebody else once you turn something down. And the project is actually becoming successful. And I have this weird mix of, I often read about actors when they turn down, like, oh, I could have been the lead in the new Star Wars, but I turned it down. Yeah.
Dan Selleck could have been Indiana Jones, right?
Right.
Tom Selleck.
Changed their whole career. So there's a little bit of that going, oh man, did I turn down the right thing? It's just an interesting thing to watch it come out and then be on the, like, the New York Times bestseller, or not bestseller list, but the, best upcoming picture book list or that kind of thing. So it's just like a new, have you guys done that before? Have you seen one of the projects that you turned down?
Yeah.
Come out?
Oh, yeah. I have. Yeah.
We talked about it. It feels weird. Tom Kendall.
Yeah.
Oh, you did?
I was supposed to do, I got offered Fart Quest, and he ended up taking the job, and he's on book 4 now, and it's like, you know, a beloved book by
do you wish you took it now, or do you think it ended up in the right hands?
It ended up in the right hands. He's
owning
that
one. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm happy for him. What were you going to say, Will?
No, just I've seen that several times, and it's a little unnerving, because it's like, I know. I've had the feeling of like, maybe I should have done that, you know?
I just wasn't into like wizards and schools for little wizard children. I just, it didn't sound good. So,
but I think an important lesson though, there is, know what you are interested in. Cause like, as I look at this book, I'm jealous of the press that it's starting to get. But if I had to go back in time and I was given the manuscript, I still wouldn't want to do it.
Also, you know what I mean? Have you ever thought maybe it's successful because that person did it?
Yeah. Right. That's what I mean by like, maybe it ends up in the right hands when you turn it down. But it's,
how about the ones
funny
that you missed that did really well? Like you didn't get a chance to turn them down because they didn't go with you. Like they called in your portfolio. You knew you were up for the job. They went with someone else, and then it did really well.
That stings too a little bit.
That's happening.
Yeah, all of it. Okay, let me ask you guys a question. This will see how honest you are.
Oh no.
When you turn down a project and you're like in the bookstore, maybe there's a banner that says, hey, this book just released, but doesn't have a picture yet. Do you sort of hope that it sucks? Somebody else did it. Do you sort of hope that it's not good?
I turn them around. I face them in.
Ensuring their doom. At the library when it's just this fine out. That's funny. I've had one book where I actually didn't get the job, like you were saying, and the artist did a great job. And I still think though I could have done as good a job or better job. And other ones I've seen that I turned down where the artist totally flopped. And I'm just like, well, maybe that story wasn't really that illustratable. The artist didn't do that well. I don't know. I'm kind of on the fence about it. I mean, I'm happy for these people when I see these successes, but, It's always strange. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I was up for The Marvelous Toy. I can't remember the name of the publisher. I think it was Sterling. And it was a song by Peter, Paul, and Mary. So there was I knew that I wanted to get that job because my parents would finally go, wow, you're really someone, you know. This was a long time ago, you know. Yeah. And, you know, you're illustrating a book by Peter, Paul, and Mary, which half of our audience has no idea who that is. But anyway, I didn't get it. And it did well. And I'm like, and I looked at some of the decisions that the artist made. I can't remember the name of the illustrator that did it. And I thought, I would not have made those choices, but those are some dang good choices.
Yeah.
And then I had this fear of like, would I have screwed it up or would I have done equally as well? Cause obviously you're not going to make the same book, right? Would it have done as well commercially or not? I don't know.
Right.
All right. Let's finish this out.
Wrap it up.
All right, everybody. Thank you for joining us. 3-Point Perspective is made possible by svslearn.com, where becoming a great illustrator starts. Your hosts have been today Lee White, Will Terry, and Jake Parker. Will Terry's work can be found online at willterryart.com, and you can follow him at it's willterry.com. You can follow him at willterryart on Instagram. And then for Lee White, you can find his work online at leewhiteillustration.com. And you can also find his work on Instagram at leewhiteillo. And my work online can be found at mrjakeparker.com and also on Instagram at jakeparker. Podcast produced by Daniel Tu. That's Daniel T-U. And you can find his work at daniel2.co. Special thanks to our SVS production manager, David Bro, and thank you to our social media specialist, Lisa Fott. Now, if you'd like this episode, please share it around, subscribe to it on iTunes and or whatever podcasting app you use, and leave a review. I'd love to hear what you think. And if you're wanting to join in on this particular discussion, log on to svslearn.com. Over there, we have a forum free to join where we have posted this episode in its own thread. So chime in over there and let us know your thoughts on what we talked about today. All right, I think that's it. Thanks, guys, and see you next time.